And with me is our guest this week, Jeff Broughton. Jeff is Associate Professor. He teaches at the School of Theology with Charles Sturt University. And I have to say, he's also my doctoral supervisor, so I have to be very nice to Jeff.
It's not an arrangement people are familiar with Stan Grant having a supervisor, is it?
No.
I want to know a bit about that.
I don't know. What's it like being my supervisor, Jeff?
What's it like being your supervisor? I thought I was past imposter syndrome. But it came back with a vengeance when I realised I was going to be supervising you. But look, I have really enjoyed our conversations. It's probably been a different kind of relationship with most students, partly because of the thinking you've already done, the experiences you've had. But I feel like it's just a rich conversation with it together.
No, it's fantastic. And the great thing about it is that I always walk away from those conversations asking more questions. Constantly, the whole process of doing the thesis has been a process of just unpacking so much and challenging my own ideas and going into the really, really dangerous places. Mm-hmm. It's taken me to the darkest and most dangerous places I think I've ever been in my life, to be honest.
Yes, which is maybe not a good advertisement for doing a PhD with me, but is a good advertisement for the way theology should be done.
Yeah.
And too much theology, and you hinted at too much church, is playing it safe.
Yeah.
And when churches and theologians play it safe, no wonder they can't find God.
Well, you know, the two great holy days, last Christmas we were together and we went to Christmas Eve service. I struggled to find God there.
Let's not say where that was.
No. But yeah. I struggled to find. Maybe that's me. Maybe that's me. I come out of a different tradition.
Yep.
I come out of the churches of the mission. I come out, you know, we're Old Testament people, and we're Jesus people too, and we play for keeps in those places.
Yep.
There's nothing comforting. We're not looking for a holy hug. We're looking to go into the deep, and also, you know, Good Friday as well. I find myself often in those places, feeling as if I'm apart in some way. I understand, you know, I enjoy the fellowship, I enjoy the encouragement because we need encouragement in faith. But I sit there sometimes and I'm going, I need something else. I need something else. The questions that I'm asking are different questions, because I'm coming at this, and that's the wonderful thing, isn't it, about the Bible? It's the wonderful thing about faith, is that we can come to that in our way.
Yeah, so I think, and some people think this is just being clever with words, and maybe it is, but the question, where do I find God, is probably, to me as a theologian, less interesting than where does God find me? And part of the problem, and it's part of our Western tradition, and in the Anglican Church, which I'm a part of, part of our English tradition, is we are better at hiding. And so church is a place where people can hide. Hide from each other and hide from God. And what we experienced out at MacArthur Church on Easter Sunday, you said around the fire, there was nowhere to hide.
Nowhere to hide. It's a beautiful way to put it. And in the simplicity, because this is where Jesus preached. You know, in the open, under the trees, on the mountains, by the water, there is nowhere to hide. And of course, there shouldn't be, because it's all around you, isn't it?
And so for a lot of people of faith down through the centuries, and we've talked about this in terms of your own experience and also more generally First Nations people, it's at the point of suffering, and often intense personal suffering, that you realise you have nowhere to hide. And so that's where often people discover, they think they discover God, is probably more properly where God has discovered them, in
that
place of suffering, because I can no longer hide.
What's your thinking about this, Jeff? Because, I mean, I know that Stan's been thinking about this and living this for a very long time, but as a theologian who has encountered, through this work you've been doing with Stan, the concept of Yinjimara,
yes,
how has that revolutionised your own theological approach or thinking?
Revolutionised probably a bit strong, to be fair, Jack, but it's certainly, it's deepened my understanding. So one of the it's not just an idea. One of the helpful things for me in terms of my own work as a theologian, but really my own life of faith, is to think about theology and discipleship as a way. That's how it's described in scriptures. The first Christians were known as people of the way. Particularly in Mark's gospel, people were with Jesus on the way. The Greeks there is interesting. It's actually this idea of inhabiting the way, not just being on something, like but inhabiting the way.
That's very close to us.
Well, I was going to say, and Yinjimara has helped me understand the depths of that in ways that just knowing the Greek meaning hasn't. That there is a way, not just that we follow, yes, but there's a way that we inhabit, that inhabits us as well. Like it's this, you can't sort of, it's not just conceptual. We want to reduce things in theology in the university to a set of concepts that can be written down, and then faith properly is never just about concepts. Theology is always struggling to adequately articulate what a way of life looks like. And Yinjimara for me is an ancient way that gives depth to my way of...
Here's something I've been thinking of, I think about a lot. I do a lot of reading, a lot of thinking. And I was just saying to Jeff, Jack a bit earlier, I do the reading because I have to. And I know people in my family who have no need of it. Because they're already there. They inhabit that. I took Jack out to Warren Gesda Mission, where we had a gathering of our people, the people who were descended of the people of that mission. That mission was set up as a place of holy refuge to stop us being slaughtered. We survived the slaughter because of that place. And people there, Jack, inhabited a place of God. You felt that, didn't you?
Absolutely. And what was interesting is that Warren Gesda was also a site of destruction and of evil. You know, Father John Gribble, who was the man who set up the mission, the Camp of Mercy as it is, he was also a violent man.
Conflicted
man. But the sacred still existed there nonetheless in the face of that contradiction and complexity. That's what you felt when you get there. You looked out, you saw just dirt road stretching, deep trees, God's Cathedral, as you say, Stan, the river. And there's a silence there where you know what it is to show Yinjimara, because you're surrounded by people who are defined by their way of being in Yinjimara.
Do you have a similar experience? Because you spend a lot of time in Central Australia, don't you?
Yep.
And what do you find there? Or, to use your way of putting it, what does God find in you there?
So, John is the elder I know in Central Australia, John Kavanagh, an East Aranda elder, and I've known John for nearly a decade and learned a lot from him about his way, his country, from his old people. But if I had to condense it all down to one thing, which is very... it challenges my sort of Western Enlightenment way of being in the world. Almost, John would say, almost everything that is of value to him has been handed to him. And I am tempted to think I've earned it, I've studied it, I've constructed it, I've assembled it, I've accumulated it. And John would be all those things that you have, Jeff, I think you'll find are relatively unimportant. What is of value is what's handed to you. Now, there's enough of the theologian in me that recognises the truth of that. But John gets it, not just because he's a person of Christian faith, but because he's a person of deep Aranda culture and spirituality.
Is there also enough of the theologian in you to sometimes think we can be smarter than God? Because we know a lot of this work is people trying to actually get one up on God, be a bit smarter, work God out.
Possibly, although I can't even be smarter than my PhD students, so I think being smarter than God is probably a bit beyond me. No, look, I think we, if that's another way of talking about hiding from God.
Well, it's another way too of saying, I studied it, I earned it.
Yes.
And yet John can sit there and say, in all that humility, I've been given.
Yes.
And this raises the question of discipleship, Jeff. Like, so to be a disciple, you know, in Christian thinking, you talk about a way. I just finished reading Bonhoeffer on, costly grace and cheap grace. Discipleship involves sacrifice, seems to me, to be what he's saying.
Yes.
How do you come
Christ
to that?
When Christ bid a man or a person come follow me, he bids him come and die.
Mm.
It's this sort of, you know, yeah, that's, we don't like hearing that.
So part of the impulse to hide is to run from that burden?
Look, again, part of life of as we have tried to arrange it is to avoid death and avoid thinking about death. But all the great traditions, Christianity isn't alone here, all the great spiritual traditions would say you can only live well in the face of your own death. You go right across. So it's more of a secular view, is that word influence, that we avoid death, properly understood Christianity and any spiritual life lives with the reality of death to live well.
And I think that's our people, isn't it? I was utterly bemused, dismayed, but not surprised at the response to COVID, because there is this belief in the West, and the West is predicated on this belief, isn't it, that the human becomes God and the human is immortal. And we now believe that we have the right not to die, to stay alive, be kept alive. We've stretched the limits of our longevity to right out to the farthest reaches. And during COVID, there was this thing, I will sacrifice being with my family, saying goodbye to my parents, attending funerals, because I'm going to lock myself away and stay alive. I understood the medical arguments for that and the responsibilities we have to each other. But as a First Nations person who lives with the reality of death and no fear of it, with the knowledge that death unites us with God and the everlasting and with our people who are never gone from us, I just don't get it. I didn't get it. And I think it's a fundamental difference between Western modernity and the rest of us, don't you?
And certainly my limited experience, like I'm a modern Western person, but a little bit of travel in India and Africa, but yes, again, with friends in Central Australia, it's harder to avoid death. And so people have made friends with the idea of dying. We almost joke about it. We have the expression, a living death. We suggest there's something worse than death, but we don't know what to do with that. So it's a living death. What does that actually mean? It's actually, I'm still alive, but it's death-like. Well, that's kind of the trap we set for ourselves, I think.
It's one of the things I've really sort of explored in doing the work with you and doing the doctoral work and taking those thoughts that have been with me, the experiences that I've had, my experiences travelling overseas, the study that I've done. And I arrived at this one, and I wanted to run this by you because I think it's the essence of where our world finds itself today and why I find myself uneasy in the world. And that is that modernity begins with this question, the question that I could never ask. A Wiradjuri person, any First Nations person in Australia, in my view, could never ask. But it's the beginning of Western modernity. Does God exist? That had never been asked until it was asked at a particular point in time, post-Reformation, post 30 Years' War, the Enlightenment, the age of reason. When you ask to me, does God exist? I can hear the burners of Auschwitz churning. I can hear the gulags coming. I think once you've opened that door, you've opened the door to hell. And the West has been in this struggle to answer that question, and to answer that question with saying, in effect, we become God, and Nietzsche essentially says this. But that, do you think that's a fundamental, in theological terms, is there an element of a fall in that? When we ask that question, does God exist?
Well, there's a sense in which One answer would be this takes us back to our origin stories, and our origin stories in the garden. And it may be one way, what you've just been talking about, one way of understanding why eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil actually was the fall, because it's actually, that's the root of the question.
It's the knowledge.
Without eating from that tree, would we have asked the question, does God exist?
Well, Immanuel Kant says, when he says, what is enlightenment?
Mm.
To dare to know.
Mm.
And I was I was always really...
To dare.
Exactly.
Yeah.
To dare to know.
Mm.
To dare. Do we dare? And if we dare, are we ready for the consequences?
Mm.
Kant wrestled with the idea, he accepted the reality of the existence of God, but it's almost like he wanted to lasso God, bring God down to earth, tame God,
yes,
domesticate God.
Absolutely, yep.
And turn God into an object of our rational minds.
Yep.
If we could not rationally conceive of it, then God had no place. We're still struggling with this, aren't we?
Even in the church, even in theology.
How in the church and theology?
Mm.
So I've spent quite a bit of my adult life pastoring Anglican churches, St John's Glebe. I've mentioned the opening of the podcast, as where I was once the senior pastor, where Scartree Ministry now inhabits. And, well, Glebe's a bit different, and Darlinghurst, where also, where again, there's people who suffer, who need to be real. There's less places to hide. But if I go back to that sort of idea, if we can hide from God, then we've put God in his place. And we get him out on Sunday morning for an hour or two. We get our God dose, whatever that looks like.
The holy hug, as I often
Well, the holy hug, you know, in some traditions it'll be someone preaching a long sermon. In another tradition it'll be sort of a certain style of music. For others, it's the sacrament. These are all good things.
Yeah, they're good things.
But we get out, take our God dose and go home. And that's how God gets domesticated in our churches.
And you hear people talking about the Enlightenment as if it is the last word, as if it is utterly virtuous. And then you find this, which I find such a strange conjunction, is this idea that the Enlightenment contains God and faith. Those two things were always in tension, weren't they? That's the point of the birth of modernity, is born in that tension.
To a large extent, I think, to be a little bit fair to some Enlightenment thinkers, I think for some of them it was a genuine pursuit of truth that they didn't find satisfactorily answered in the churches and in the traditions of the day. So,
and a reaction against dogma too. Right?
Exactly, and exactly right, yes.
Superstition.
Religion slash faith being different things. You know, if you think about Hume's critique, for example, if you think about Voltaire, they're often critiquing the institution of the church, which has become dogmatic. Mm. It's fulfilled, actually, the very problem that the Enlightenment thinkers then did themselves. Try to act with certainty on behalf of mystery.
Well, and you get Leibniz arriving at the idea of theodicy.
Mm.
How do you explain the existence of evil in the world? It's a fascinating time because they're wrestling with those big ideas. But if we fast forward today, 300 years later, where do we find truth? And why is it in the West that religion is rapidly receding? The last census shows that by the next census, you would expect there will be more people without faith than people of faith. And Christianity has now dropped below 50%
of days.
But the rest of the world is not the case. So what does this tell us about the Enlightenment, the legacy of the Enlightenment, modernity, and God's place in the world?
Short answer to that, Steve.
Yes.
So in terms of our own census data, it's less of a shock to me because having worked in the inner city for over 20 years, I've always kind of dealt with the presupposition that most of the people who live locally to the church where I'm ministering are not only not people of faith, but people have had little connection to the church. Now, in some way, that's refreshing. That suits my style in ministry, not to have to wade through all the sort of, oh, I went to a private school kind of, yes. you know. So there's, it's not entirely to be lamented.
Mm.
Because the reality probably has been, whilst there's been higher adherence to Christian denominations in the past, I'm not sure that faith has disappeared as rapidly.
I love that.
Wow.
I love that. Because every morning I get up and go for a walk along the beach at Coogee, and I see young people, particularly young people, out for the sunrise. Now, they could be in bed, they could be doing any number of things, but they're out there in the cold of winter even, waiting for that first sunrise. Now, that's a yearning.
Absolutely.
There's the God-filled hole, the God hole in us that needs to be filled. Whatever we call it, the language of God, the church and the place of the church has been displaced.
Yes.
But the yearning continues, doesn't it?
And the sense in which that's a judgment on my profession, whether that's as a minister of religion or as a theologian, is that those people, and I count my own kids, 21-year-old and 19-year-old, to satisfy that yearning, the church is now one of the last places they'd look, rather than in a generation or two, it would have been one of the first places. Our grandparents, if they'd grown up outside the church and had a sense, and this is in a sense true for my great-grandmother, who's my great-grandfather, left her with four young kids. My grandfather was 7 years old. Desperate need of help, World War One, post-World War One. What am I going to do? I'll go to the church. And that's how my family reconnected with the church, because she was desperate. If that was my daughter in 2023, I suspect the church would not be the first place she'd think of.
She might whether be a desperation judge in the church.
or desperation or yearning or whatever it is, the church is now not that place people think.
You know, I'm a young person myself, and I think about my friends and what we're all searching for, which is that meaning. And the church has, in many ways, and I don't use this word lightly, but colonized the idea of God. Right? It's become in many ways about control and judgment,
yes.
not about embrace and love. Like, as you have said to me before, Stan, God can be found too in the Mardi Gras. You've written about this place of love.
Well, you know, God is love.
Exactly.
That's often the purest expression I see of love. And people with the courage to love.
Exactly.
The love that God put in them in a world that where they can be killed in some parts of the world for that love. But the church still matters, doesn't it? I mean, I wrestle with the idea of, you know, you hear this thing, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious.
Yeah, nonsense.
That nonsense. It's always felt like a cop out for me.
Because you take and don't give back. There's no surrender. There's no demand on you.
And you can opt out. You can choose your bits that you like, and you can. What is the role, and what are the things that are fundamental in God's word, and as we inhabit that and the places in which we inhabit that, the places of worship that are still important, what is the place for that word and the places where we inhabit that word in a society where people would rather go to the Mardi Gras, and often we'll find God there in a way they won't find in a church.
Yeah, we opened the podcast with some reflections on Easter, and at its best, the church and theology, and this is right across the different traditions, you know, the Catholics do it through the Mass, others do it through their preaching, others through their worship. The centrality of that Christ event, if I can use that code word, is where's God? And this was Luther's answer. Don't look for God in the glory and riches of the Vatican. The glory of God is found in the shame of the cross. So that's where God is. So where's God? God's not going to be, and you know, we still fall for this every time. You know, a celebrity becomes a person of faith, whether it's a sports person or an ABC journalist, and everyone wants to be part of it. Who cares? Now, Luther says, the church's best says, God is found in the least likely places. Don't look for God in the celebrate, in the social media influence, in the sports person. Look for God in the unexpected place. And if we can train ourselves to look there, and that's what Easter makes us do. On a rugged Roman cross in a forgotten tomb, that's where we find God. And that's why First Nations people, people who are suffering, people in Africa in their droves and in parts of India and Asia are turning to that God. Mm. They're not coming to God because of the celebrities. Mm. They're coming to God because actually God is found amongst us. And that's at the heart of the Christian story captured in this book, God with us and God for us.
And this raises the question too of God's justice, Jeff. So if the question is not, does God exist for these people who are suffering? The question is God just? And how I answer that, or if I cannot answer that, how do I live in light of that? Would you say, Stan?
Oh, it's a fundamental question for us, in the same way that I could never imagine asking myself, does God exist?
Mm.
That, for me as a Wiradjuri person, is absurd. Mm. But is God just? Does God care? Most definitely. The fact that we pray for an end to our suffering and it doesn't end, I have to confront those things all the time. The books that speak to me as a First Nations person are the books of suffering and sorrow. Job, Jeremiah, parts of Deuteronomy, and most definitely Lamentations. Most definitely Lamentations, where the cry is, where are you? And the answer is silence and distance. How do you hold your faith in a world where we see not just injustice and suffering, but the perpetrators of injustice and suffering prospering?
Well, the first thing to say is to admit that more often I have more connection to those who are the perpetrators than the victims.
Mm.
So I'm often on the wrong side of that equation, in terms of both not just family history, but as a middle class, Western educated male, that's the reality. So I need to ask myself, what benefits do I get from the perpetrators not being brought to justice? It's not just an abstract question.
Mm.
And I think that is not far below the surfaces when we start to talk about this, you know. It's hard for me to speak honestly about this without, in a sense, trying to exonerate myself. But if I'm not about exonerating myself, then it's knowing that... And perhaps Moltmann was the first theologian to really...
Jürgen Moltmann,
great German theologian.
Credited with writing the first theology after Auschwitz.
Exactly.
And he's implicated.
He served
in the Nazi army.
A German man.
Mm.
Yeah. That somehow the Christian story and the Christ event needs to speak to both victim and perpetrator.
But equally or not? Because we know that God is unequivocal. And Jesus says time and again, I'm not here to bring peace, I'm here to bring a sword.
Yes.
I will avenge injustice. Yes. I am on the side of those who suffer.
Yeah.
So if God is there for the perpetrator and the victim, whose side is God on?
the scriptural tradition would be God would be more on the side of the victim.
And yet, here we are, and this is what I come back to time and again. If God is on our side, why doesn't God let up? Because 200 years later, we are the most impoverished and imprisoned. I've buried a 37-year-old niece this year, and it won't be the last. I look around at our people, and we die 10 years younger. I look at my parents who carry the wounds and their soul and their bodies of this nation, and it doesn't let up. And we pray, and it doesn't let up.
It's an unsatisfying answer on one level, but I hope it's also true. It's because people like me, people who are more often on the side of the perpetrator, still pretend God is on our side.
But is God on your side?
No.
Is God on us? But people prosper here with their injustice. You know, the perpetrator sleeps very comfortably.
Yes.
And we continue to suffer in the hard ground. As I struggle with this, I come to a couple of conclusions. One is that I have to accept that I live in a world where these things are possible, and they happen to us.
Yeah.
And that in crying out for God to end the suffering, I'm asking the wrong thing, because what God has given us in the suffering is the grace and the hope unseen.
Yes.
And the grace and the hope in love that the perpetrator perhaps will never find. I've had to accept that I've been maybe asking the wrong question. And I've really come to sit in the idea of something, and I wanted to talk to you about, that I think we've lost in the world. And that is, you used the word a little bit earlier, lament. Lament. The Oprah world is a world where everyone gets a happy ending. We get a hug from Oprah. We get closure. We hear that word a lot. We think we can find healing and reconciliation. We hear those words a lot. I've become increasingly comfortable with the idea of the lament and the grace in the lament. The lament, the prayer to the silent God. The lament that there is today with no promise of tomorrow. The lament of the cross, and we don't know about what's coming on Sunday. The Saturday where we went out and sat around that fire, and on that Saturday, as the disciples hid away in fear without knowing that Jesus would rise again, we sat in that silence. We've abandoned lament in the world because it doesn't reward us. But what have we lost if we can't sit in lament?
The truth. The ability to meet God in the shame of the cross and the hope of the resurrection. We'd lose just about everything, I would have thought. As you guys, I don't want to make this political, but I was just, it struck me as I was listening to you then, Stan, wow, I wonder whether Australia, whether I'm ready to hear the voice of lament from your people. In a sense, a voice to Parliament that about reckon, that's the easy part.
It's easy.
Can I hear those voices that cry out? The lament of the stolen generation, the lament of those who were massacred in the frontier wars.
And you know the thing about the lament, Jeff, is the lament, and you know, when you read Lamentations, it's the voice of sorrow and sadness and abandonment and forsakenness. Sometimes it's the voice of anger, but it's never the voice of vengeance. Even in Lamentations, no one says, I'm going to get you, God.
No, not vengeance to God. There's a bit of vengeance in the Psalms.
There's vengeance, but in lament.
Yes, no, there's not.
There's not a vengeance in lament, and I think that's what makes it hard for Australia. Australia could deal with it if we were revengeful, resentful people.
Yeah.
But the lament of the stolen generation, the lament of the sadness, is too much for Australia to bear, isn't it?
Yeah. In one of the classes I teach for CCU on Aboriginal culture and spirituality, we watched that scene from Rabbit Proof Fence when the children were stolen, and I think if you know the scene where the women are wailing, hitting their head, there's some students who cannot watch that. It's too confronting. That's too powerful, that lament. And we need to hear it. We need to sit with it, as you say. We want to rush to Easter Sunday. We want to rush to resolution and resurrection. And we've got some, a lot of lamenting to do. And on some of us, for some of us, repenting. We haven't even begun to think about the repentance necessary.
We want to get to reconciliation. We don't want the repentance, do we?
There is no reconciliation without repentance.
What is the relationship, Jeff, between lament and love? You know, I just reread Mark, and he's a man of sorrows in that, isn't he, Jesus Christ? You know, even the final cry is one of lament. It's not one of hope, even. Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. My God, why have you forsaken me? Does love reside in the lament? Is the lament a love, a sad love song to God, a broken-hearted love song to God? What's the relationship there? We always hear this word love in the Christian message, but where does that sit with the lament?
Well, there's the forsakenness is the sense of the absence of that love. That's what it is. What's Jesus' agony on the cross? It's not just that he's dying. It's not just that he's physically and psychologically and every other way suffering in ways I can't even imagine, which, again, First Nation people and people of other parts of the world get a much better sense of what it's like. You know, some of the liberation theologians say, look to the crucified people of the world. That's not my particular experience. But all of that, the agony is that this is happening. It's what you're saying earlier, is that it seems that evil is having its day. Like, Jesus went to the cross thinking he was God's anointed. That this is the way Israel is going to be saved. And here he is, outside the city, on a cross between two other wrongdoers, two other criminals. Where's God? What's happened? So it's the absence of love, it's the absence of hope. Now, again, don't want to rush to this because it's rushing to Resurrection Sunday, but again, theologians are quick to point out Jesus is actually quoting Psalm 22 there, and that's how it opens. And by the end of the psalmist has remembered the love. So love is made the more powerful by its absence and the hope. And so lament always has to be the hope, even in the Lamentations where the psalmist says the hope. You know, remember us, O Lord, unless you're forsaken us. There is not the absence of hope.
Well, it's all you've got left at that point. We've talked about, this is another thing that I've, as I've continued to go deeper and deeper into this, in a way, taking me back to where I was when I was a boy. I was raised in this. I was born into the Church of the Forsaken. I saw people praying with a ferocity that would shake the walls, and to feel God in that room shaking the walls. I saw that. I experienced that. I spent a lifetime trying to understand that, to chase down the burrows of philosophy and theology and reporting the great stories of the world to arrive back at a place at Warringesda, where there is not a slither of light between me and God and my country. And to sit in that state of lament. And it's also revealed something else to me that I put to you, and when I did, you took a gasp when I said, I don't think that white people can come to God in this country. And remember, as it says in Psalm 43, of an ungodly nation. And I believe Australia is an ungodly nation, not godless and not without God. But there is, it has acted in an ungodly way. That people can't come to God in this land unless it is through us. How do you feel about that? As someone who God has found, but is God to find you through us in this country? What is it, what's God asking of us in this land?
It might be that Injamara actually helps here, that the way I hear that is no one, particularly a white person like me, a white Christian, can come to God without First Nations people also part of that story. Again, as a theologian, I want to say I come to God through Christ. That's the is the way, truth and life, to use that
as
language.
As we do.
Yes, we all do. But I can't take that journey. I can't come to God through Christ without First Nations people. And the church, by and large, and certainly much of Australia, would rather leave it at leave First Nations people. That's in the past. Let's move forward. And that's not an option. So I agree with that part.
As I've thought about it, I've also seen it sitting with our idea of time, because God always was, always will be. we don't see time in a linear fashion. There is no space between Good Friday and Easter Sunday. It is happening at the same time. Jesus was here as he was there. He always was. Before he was born, he always was and always will be. And I think that's how I see the idea of people coming to God in this country, is to surrender to the place, to the place God gave us, to the always was, always will be notion of time and God, and that there is, and this is where Paul speaks to me with the idea, and I know a lot of white conservative Christians throw this back at us as the sort of argument against what they see in inverted commas as identity politics. There is no Jew, there is no Gentile, and so on. No, there isn't. But that wasn't written for us. We never put the walls up. That's written for the people who have put the walls up. To find yourself here, where there is not a slither of light between God, place, and people. There are no Aboriginal people and white people. Yindyamara opens a space of God, eternal, always was, always will be, here in this country, for all. And I think, sadly still, we see this as being people out to save us, Christianize us, or, as you say, draw a line in the sand, move on, move forward, time heals all wounds, all of these platitudes. And in essence, what God is saying is, I have always been here. I always will be here in these people of this place of whom you are now a part. That's the missed opportunity, I feel, in Australia, theologically.
Missed opportunity, but one, and you might be able to explain better to me because I've experienced it through friendship with you, but consistently, whether it's 25-year friendship with Ray Minikin, working with John Kavanagh in Central Australia, and I can add just many other names. Arnie Jean Phillips has been a generous, generous friend over many decades as well. The invitation is always, welcome, join us. Join us in the journey. So that's another layer on your question of how do white people come to God in this land that we now call Australia. It has been my experience through the welcome and invitation.
I share that feeling exactly. You know, the thing I've learned is, travelling around with Stan these past few months, I've learned so much about love and so much about my own suffering too. You know, being with Stan's people, seeing people who suffer so deeply, yet the joy of love just pours through their bones in ways I've never seen before. You know, Stan, when you're playing music with your people, particularly when I'm part of that, it's reminded me that there are ways to, you know, William Blake has that phrase, there is a moment in each day which Satan cannot find. And your people, Stan, have reminded me of
might
that.
Might be a bit longer than a moment.
might be a bit longer than a moment, and I hope it will be. But that the remembrance that that does and can happen, in mysterious ways I don't quite understand. You know, that is a very moving thing, and maybe, it's only offered because it's of the generosity.
Maybe in Yindyamara ways you don't quite understand, rather than mysterious.
Maybe in Yindyamara ways. Maybe to be as the way is a mysterious way, Yindyamara.
Well, it's always there. And I think for me, the lesson in my own journey of faith and my own journey through the world and my curiosity and wrestling with my own history is that my people have always been there and God has always been there. I've gone off chasing other things to come back to a place where there are no questions to be asked about that. God is real. Our people are there. This is our place. And we live in God's love, even when we experience the suffering of the world and the separation between what we are capable of doing in the world and yet the existence of God at the same time. Yindyamara, and it's not a theodicy, because it's not, I don't think we're trying to excuse God or to excuse the worst, but it is just the knowledge that, and you can't even put it into words, when I go home, it is just there. Like the stars in the sky and the water in the rivers and the it is just there. It's a beautiful thing. Have you ever had... Do you experience what we call the crisis of faith? As someone who inhabits this and wrestles with all of these questions?
Probably not in that language. I certainly struggle at times with things that I see happening and things at times that have happened to me, but I don't know why, but you said much earlier that you've never asked really the question, does God exist? And to be honest, if I've spent time thinking about that, I don't remember it. Mm. I was adopted at birth into a Christian family, and I am very grateful for the faith of my adopted parents, Mum and Dad. Mum died many years ago, and Dad, who's nearly 90, like your dad, in his final stages. But the gift of their faith was something that I was willing and wanted to embrace. And so it's hard for me to think and conceive of my life independent of God, although at times, obviously, I've not always lived consistently in faith. So no, it's not a crisis of faith. I think my struggle has often been with the church, with other Christians, with the mob I belong to, who sometimes I think, who am I kidding? These are not my people, but they are. But, you know, I feel that, whether it's a Christmas service with you, Stan, or at other times. That's less acute at the moment now that I'm teaching theology rather than leading a church. But that's to be honest, that's more my wrestle than with God directly.
Well, Jeff, I think that, you know, just the phrase that came to me just then is I've never asked myself that question, because I think it's a question of how do we bring God into the world? You know, how do we bring love into the world where we're living in face of injustice and all the rest? And just this conversation, it's been really interesting talking to you as someone who has taught and worked with Stan, because I've had this incredible experience traveling with Stan and meeting his people and asking these questions myself. And the thing I've learned has been that it has been that Yinjimara is a way.
Yes.
It's a way that you inhabit, and that love can be found in the most inexplicable way in the midst of deep suffering.
I think also for me, just to finish up, is that my journey, my Yinjimara, has been deepened because of Jeff. The questions you have led me to ask, the year that you've been for me, has deepened my own Yinjimara and God's place in my own life. And it puts me in mind, I think, of the words of Martin Buber, the I and thou. Paul Ricoeur, who said that the shortest journey to yourself is through the other. So thank you, Jeff, and it's been a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thanks, Stan. Thanks, Jack.